Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for August 12, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics. And I've got two guests up for tonight. First, we'll speak with Deborah James, who is the executive director of the Venezuela Information Office, and she is in Washington, D.C., which is an information service of the Venezuelan government, an admittedly partisan source. But she is down in Caracas now preparing watching the preparations for the referendum on President Chavez's continued rule, which is coming up this weekend. And we'll get her view on things from the capital of Venezuela. And then a little after the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Robert McChesney, who is a professor of communications at the University of Illinois and author of the book The Problem of the Media, U.S. Communication Politics in the 21st Century, which was published a couple of months ago by Monthly Review Press. And been trying to get Bob on, but just hasn't worked out. But finally, we've got him cornered. And a few words from the economic headlines before we get to the meat of today's show. Just noticing as I came in here that crude oil closed up 70 cents today, $45.50 a barrel, very high price, not in real terms anything like the prices we saw 1979-80, but still the highest levels we've seen in a very, very long time. And it's really, in a lot of ways, dominating the economic picture these days. It Merrill Lynch has estimated that every additional dollar of on the oil price knocks a tenth of a point of GDP growth. So we're up about $15 from where we were about 2 years ago. So that is really exerting quite a slowdown effect on the United States economy and the rest of the world economy. Just before the war in Iraq began, Rupert Murdoch was enthusing that the conquering Iraq would bring us $20 oil and universal prosperity. That didn't quite work out that way. Rupert's dreams have been dashed so far. Many reasons for these high oil prices these days. First, Wall Street has been pressuring oil companies to cut their exploration budgets to keep profits high, so supply growth has been limited. Some people are arguing that the oil supply has reached some sort of permanent peak and we're on the downslope now. I think that's overdone. History is full of such pronouncements that have turned out not to be true. But it is the case that demand has been growing rather strongly from the United States in particular, SUVs and everything else that we're famous for, and also China, which has been growing very, very rapidly. Those things have certainly contributed to a higher demand for oil. At the same time, the supply has not been growing. And add to that the anxiety, the fact that Iraq is still not back to its peak production levels, that there's a lot of anxiety about disruptions of Iraqi supplies, of Saudi supplies, of a lot of political anxieties around the Middle East in general. Add up all those things, you have very tight markets, little spare capacity among the producers. So that is giving us $45 plus oil, which is something we haven't seen in quite some time. The stock market down 123 points, in part, I think, of growing recognition that the economic slowdown, which first appeared in the scene with the release of the June employment report about a month ago, and continued through most of the economic releases for June, seems to be continuing into July and maybe something a little more serious, as I've been arguing here for several weeks now. That it's not just, as some people in Wall Street were saying, a soft patch, but a real slowdown of some significance that could affect us for the rest of the year. I think Wall Street is now coming around to that point of view, having shaken off some of their optimism. Tuesday, the Federal Reserve announced that they were raising interest rates another quarter point, the federal funds rate, the interest rate under their most direct control, the rate at which banks lend each other money overnight. The statement that they issued along with that policy decision sounded rather tough. That is, the very patient and accommodative Federal Reserve of earlier this year is now being replaced by one that seems confident that economic growth is strong seems kind of worried about high oil prices and rising inflation, and is pushing up rates. We'll see if they stick to this pattern. If the data continues to come out weak, they are certainly very flexible, so they're not going to stick to any preconceived scripts. But right now, I think they're more optimistic than they should be, so we will see if they continue in that. But higher interest rates will also tend to slow down the economy. Last Friday, it was reported that the U.S. Economy added just 32,000 jobs in the month of July, a very, very weak number, well below what anyone was expecting, even the more pessimistic among us. And on top of that, the estimates for job creation in May and June were also marked down. So we're not doing as well as we thought, and we're not doing very well at all in the labor market. So I'm suggesting that the June slowdown is continuing into July. No sectors really stood out as major gainers or losers, but in most industrial sectors, the job numbers were plus 1,000, plus a couple thousand, minus a couple thousand, nothing big. But temporary employment, which often is a leading indicator of where the broader labor market is going, added just 5,000, and the estimates for June's gain were revised down rather sharply. So that's not a good sign for future job growth. So a weak report, and the forward-looking indicators also weak. The number of industrial sectors that were adding jobs fell from 60% last month to 49, or rather in June, to under 50% in July, also a very sharp fall. The kinds of things that you sometimes see at the beginning of recession. So this is a very serious slowdown. The numbers may not survive. They may be revised upward. Who knows? I think 32,000 is probably overstating things on the weak side, but still, these are not good numbers. The job numbers come from two surveys. One is a survey of employers, another a survey of households. The one in the survey of households is the source of the famous unemployment report, and it also does a separate indicator of measure of employment, which have been a little stronger than those resulting from the surveys of employers. But even in that case, it's finding a very pretty low quality skew to the most of the jobs that were created. A lot of them self-employment, which is what the unemployed often call themselves, just surveyors in order to save face. A third or so of the gains were in part-time jobs, very few full-time jobs, and most of the gains were with people with high school diplomas or less. So these were generally low-pay, low-skilled, part-time, insecure jobs. So it's not a happy picture coming out of the U.S. Employment Report. And average hourly earnings rose a bit in July, but still, year on year, the wage gains are not matching inflation. So, the real wage still declining, not a happy sign. And then, let's see, retail sales for the month of July, as reported this morning, also weaker than expected, up just 0.7%. Most analysts were expecting 1.1 or higher, so a surprise on the downside again. And excluding the automobile market, which was very strong last month, just up 0.2%. Very weak performance in retail sales. So it looks like consumers are perhaps feeling tapped out, although they do report being somewhat more optimistic over the last several months. But even that measure is rolling over a little bit. The weekly ABC News Money Magazine poll of consumer attitudes fell several points last week, from minus 6 to minus 9. Not a terribly low reading, and still well above the lows that we saw in late May, early June. But it looks like at least the gain in optimism has plateaued and maybe turning downwards. It could be that the jobs numbers, the weak job report, is taking its toll on attitudes. And finally, the Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index. We had the compiler on that of that, Lakshman Ashuthan, on this show a month or two ago, and he was then saying that the index was pointing to a slowdown in the second half of this year. Well, it's continuing to be weak, and the 6-month rate of change change in that index now, just very close to zero, which is not quite flashing recession warnings, but is pretty close to that. So the economy is slowing, and it does seem to be something of a longer-term impact than the mere soft spot that some analysts were claiming earlier in the cycle a month or so ago. So let's take this little musical break and then come back and speak with Deborah James. And that excerpt from Master DJ Paul Van Dyke's Energy Mix, recorded in October 03, and downloadable from TranceAddict.com, if you're into that sort of thing, TranceAddict.com. And now we're joined on the line by Deborah James, who is the director of the Venezuela Information Center in Washington, D.C., which I should say, fairness requires me to say, is supported by the Venezuelan government. But that doesn't disqualify her analysis. Welcome to WBAI, Deborah James.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you're in Caracas. The referendum is this Sunday, right?
Yes, it certainly is.
So what do things feel like in Caracas? Give us a little report from the ground to start with.
Certainly. Well, I can tell you that the what is happening is that all of the polls that have been taken in the last 2 months of the population of the country, and these are polls taken by the opposition as well as by forces that are sympathetic to the government, have showed an increasingly strong tendency for a Chavez victory. So I can tell you that the feeling down here on the side of the government people and all of the social movement people and, you know, the peasants and indigenous folks and everybody who we work with here is very, very happy. People are feeling very strong about a very likely Chavez victory, including all of the social sectors that have been working for the revolutionary process. And I'm actually here right now at an opposition rally where I think, you know, people are trying to hold it together and still be happy, but it certainly is not anywhere near as big or as happy as I, might have been in months past when they were getting the referendum off the ground.
Tell us about this opposition. What is their social base? Who are these people?
Well, the opposition comes from the traditional Venezuelan elite. Venezuela is a very oil-rich country. Most of your listeners probably know it's the fifth largest exporter of oil in the world and has the largest reserves outside of the Middle East. So traditionally, it was a capitalist country that a very small minority of people controlled the vast resources of the entire country. And keep in mind that Venezuela is a country where, you know, there's not a lot of industrialization here. It's primarily oil wealth. And so what happened is that over time, especially during the 80s and 90s, a lot of people in the population started deciding that, you know, they weren't necessarily interested in having only a very, very small elite have access to the oil wealth of the entire country. And they started organizing and having a voice for change, much as in other Latin American countries like Argentina and Brazil. And so in 1998, that's when Hugo Chavez was elected, as part of a phenomena of the majority of the country realizing that the oil wealth actually belongs to everybody and that they needed to make sure that they had a government that believed in sharing the oil wealth equitably with all of its citizens instead of only sharing that oil wealth with a very, very tiny elite of people.
Now, I was told that there's a provision in the Venezuelan Constitution that all when the oil price is above a certain amount, that oil, all the premium over that amount must go to social development. Oil prices are now quite high by recent standards. So is that the case? And where's this money going?
It's been incredible. The amount of money that the government is spending, that the oil company actually is spending on social development and welfare, has gone from $40 million, what it's been in the pre-Chavez era, to over $2 billion this year. And that is what's happening with the windfall profits. So instead of it going to a very, very small number of people, to spend on vacations in Miami and, you know, getting plastic surgery to participate in the Miss Universe contest. They are distributing it with the entire population. They have taught over 1 million Venezuelan citizens to read and write in the last year through their literacy program, which is very close to abolishing illiteracy in Venezuela. They have 1.4 million illiterate people. And now after the program, they've educated 1.2 million how to read and write. They're continuing that program with a high elementary school equivalency. They also have a high school equivalency program. A lot of new spaces opening up for working class students to be able to participate in the university. And then one of the most popular programs, which is the Cuban doctor program, which is putting in over 50% of the population now getting free, direct, in their community preventative health care. And all of this is being paid for by revenues from the oil that are now being shared with all Venezuelans instead of a small elite.
Yeah, you mentioned this earlier, but I'd like to develop the point. In most oil-exporting countries, there is a very rich parasitical elite and not much social or industrial or economic development of any significance. I assume Venezuela follows that model.
It certainly did historically. I mean, it had a very unequal population. That's why, you know, some of the commentators who will sometimes say that Chavez has polarized the country. That's absolutely not the case. The oil riches and the way that that was managed and kept by the elite is what polarized the country to having this tremendous inequality where only a few people had access to resources and the rest were left without potable water, without, you know, cement on their floor, without any sort of road nearby, you know, obviously without health care and education. And so that's what polarized it. What's happened now is that that poor majority of the country has awoken and become very, very empowered through the model of participatory democracy that is the main government project that the Chavez government has developed and really empowered amongst the population. So, you know, everybody here says, you know, no matter what happened with President Chavez, they understand that the population has awoken and that they're very empowered. They very much believe in the participatory democracy that's inscribed into their constitution that was popularly approved by over 70% of the population in 1999. And it's an incredible thing to witness. I mean, people carry their constitutions around all the time. There are people who participated in the literacy program just so that they could learn to read and write because they were desperate to be able to read the constitution that conferred upon them new rights of political policymaking, decision-making, community control over resources, and just basic civic participation that they had never had before in the whole history of the country.
I'm speaking with Deborah James, who is now in Caracas, but her job is normally as executive director of the Washington-based Venezuela Information Office. Let's talk about what exactly is in the ballot on Sunday. Where did this is it somewhat like the California recall?
It somewhat is, yes. Well, it started actually this whole process back in April of 2002 when the opposition that has been, you know, so resistant to sharing oil wealth equitably with all Venezuelans, organized a fatal coup against the democratically elected government. As most of your listeners probably know, they organized a coup on April 11, 2002, that temporarily forced the president out of office. He was taken away to a military base. And within 2 days, an alliance basically of hundreds of thousands of poor Venezuelans out in the streets clamoring for electoral democracy to be restored with the more loyal forces within the military were able to restore him to his democratically elected office. And that is probably the only coup against a democratically elected leftist government that has ever been reversed. And it was just an incredible phenomena just due to the massive pressure by so many citizens out in the streets. And so, you know, that was one of the major first projects that they did. They lost that. Obviously, the coup was overturned. That fall, the opposition then organized in December of 2002 and January of 2003 an illegal insurrectionary management-led work stoppage. And they basically shut down the oil company, you know, having lost control over the military through their coup. Then they went after the PDVSA, which is the main oil company that provides the majority of the revenues for the state. And they shut it down, and they cost the economy over $10 billion. They caused a 10% contraction in the economy for the entire year, and unemployment was raised about 5%. Can you imagine 5% of the population going out of work just because of that management-led worker lockout strike? And that was ended at the end of January of 2003 with the government being able to regain control over the state-owned oil company. And so that was their second attempt through an extra constitutional illegal means to overthrow the government. After that, the Organization of American States and the Carter Center were brought in as mediators between this opposition that had attempted so many extra-constitutional illegal means to get rid of the president and the government forces. And they brokered an agreement in May of 2003, which said that it forced the opposition to try to go with the Constitution to try to get the president out of office instead of always trying illegal means. And that led to the process of the referendum. Venezuela's is the only constitution in the Western Hemisphere that allows for a recall against any elected official if the citizens feel that they haven't been doing their job, as long as they meet the constitutional requirements. So then they did a signature gathering period that was marked by a massive amount of fraud. Over 10% of the signatures were thrown out because they were alleged signatures of dead people, of children, of foreigners, of all kinds of shenanigans that the opposition engaged in. But in May, the National Electoral Council, which is the arbiter of elections in Venezuela, the National Electoral Council, the CNE, did rule that they had actually gained enough signatures to trigger the referendum, and the date was set for August 15th. So we're at that point now, and what's likely to be the outcome then of their, you know, year and a half struggle for a constitutional way of getting the president out of office is that it's likely to be now the third time that he will have his democratically elected mandate affirmed by the majority of the population, because he's very, very likely, all polls indicate that he's going to win the referendum this Sunday.
This is an impressive degree of popular mobilization. It sounds like this is not just a revolutionary elite, but something with deep social roots.
Oh, you mean from the opposition?
No. The government itself, the Chavez government, it seems to enjoy a considerable popular support, and it's proving easy to topple
incredible.
It.
Yeah, no. If you go into any of the poor neighborhoods, I mean, you can just see. It's kind of shocking when you go into the poor neighborhoods that there's any opposition at all, because there is just so much of an incredible, incredibly deeply held reverence and respect and a feeling of camaraderie for the president here in the country that it's just unbelievable to witness. And you can easily find people all over the place who will tell you, you know, I spent the first 70 years of my life in the dark. I didn't know how to read and write. The government had abandoned me. They didn't care about people like me. Now, for the first time, I have a president who actually cares about what happens to my life, and I'm going to vote to defend him. You better believe I'm going to go out on August 15th and vote no to recall him so that we can keep him as our president. Because I don't want them to take away my literacy program. I don't want them to take away my healthcare program. I don't want them to take away my subsidized food program for the poor. I mean, all of the incredible programs that he's done. This is also a country, I mean, probably the only country in the Western Hemisphere where you have the National Federation of Indigenous Peoples totally behind the government. They totally support the government here. The National Federation of Afro-Venezuelan People, of Black Venezuelans, the people of African descent here is very supportive of the government. The National Peasants Federation is very supportive of the government. The Women's National Women's Institute here is very supportive. And when do you see that in another country where the main sectors of the marginalized people historically of society come together to defend their government? Well, you see it in Venezuela, because the government has done so much and is so dedicated to implementing its programs and delivering on its promises to make the country more equal and to ensure that all of its citizens can participate fully in the political process and empowering them.
Well, it also sounds like, the opposition claims that the Chavez regime is dictatorial and anti-democratic, it also sounds like there's considerable degree of freedom of organization and expression.
Certainly. It's one of the most incredible things to me. I mean, certainly the opposition has a lot of reasons why they, you know, say that they're unhappy with the government. But when it comes down to freedom of expression, I mean, you can see that there is just an incredible, I mean, I'm right here at a opposition rally. It's the last one of the year today. The campaigns end, so this is going to be the last one before the referendum on Sunday. And, you know, everybody here is free to express whatever they want. I mean, the opposition controls 90% of the media in this country. All of the major private stations are run by the opposition. And I'm not just saying that they're somewhat more, you know, towards the Republicans than the Democrats, or somewhat more sympathetic to the Democrats than the Republicans. We're talking about that the major financiers of the opposition forces are the owners of the media, and where they actually participated in helping to instigate the coup against the democratically elected government. So, you know, they're a major force to be contended with. It's one of the only forces that the opposition still has, actually, is the media. So they are able to foment, an incredible feeling in the country. If you watch the media, you would think that nobody in the country actually is in favor of the government at all, which is, you know, sort of the opposite of the truth. But they do have a tremendous amount of freedom of expression here, and even, you know, organizations like Human Rights Watch that have positioned themselves to be very close to the opposition have acknowledged that there is complete freedom of expression here in Venezuela.
Now, I don't want to let that point get away. Human Rights Watch is supporting the opposition. Is that common among, like, human rights NGOs?
No, I don't think so at all. I think that I wouldn't say that, you know, they're coming out and making statements in favor of the opposition, but you can see that they as an organization have a bias to be very, very critical of everything the government does, and very non-critical of not only anything the opposition does, but the things that have been done previously in Venezuela. You know, they were not nearly so adamant about discussing as they are now, which is really unfortunate. But the good thing is that there are quite a few organizations in the United States that have recognized the importance, the historical importance of what the Chavez administration is trying to do, both for its own population domestically as well as for its incredible efforts at regional integration and supporting other countries in Latin America, and have made that support public. And in fact, just today, our office is releasing a solidarity statement in favor of the process here happening in Venezuela that was signed by people like Dennis Kucinich, people like Ed Asner, and folks like Jesse Jackson. So we're really excited about that, the new wave of support that seems to be burgeoning both in the United States as well as certainly all over the Western Hemisphere.
And finally, I read some reports the last day or two of the CIA now conceding that Chavez is likely to win the referendum, and so they're planning a coup. What do you hear?
Well, we certainly saw those reports that the CIA was down in Chile planning another alternate option. Obviously the U.S. government has been backing this referendum since even before it was constitutionally provided for. It's obviously a very big disappointment for the United States policy and people like Roger Noriega and Otto Reich that after putting so many eggs in the referendum basket, that it's actually such a democratic instrument that the people are going to reelect their president. And you can see that from their statements that they're not very happy about it. But I think that some of the more enlightened, perhaps members of the State Department, and even perhaps Colin Powell, has acknowledged that it's likely that Chavez will win. And unnamed State Department officials have even acknowledged that, they're going to have to start dealing with this guy since he will have been elected three times by the end of this process, which is obviously three times more than George Bush has been popularly elected, and that they're going to have to finally start dealing with him as a Democratic partner. And the important thing to point out is as a very, very stable and trustworthy provider of oil for the United States. Venezuela is one of the top providers of oil to the United States. And right now, especially during an electoral campaign for the presidency, the Bush administration cannot do anything that would seem as though they were doing any actions that might lead to an increase in oil prices. And all of the international analysts that look at the oil industry have noted that the oil industry, both the independent experts as well as the oil companies, are actually hoping for a Chavez victory, because that will mean stability in the oil markets. And the Chavez administration has been a very, very stable supplier of oil to the United States over the last 5 years. And the only two times that was interrupted was during the coup in April of 2002, and obviously during the oil workers' lockout strike at the end of 2002, beginning of 2003, when the oil supplies almost stopped. So they know it's really the opposition that has cut off oil supplies, and the Chavez administration that has been a good commercial partner to the United States in ensuring that we in the United States can buy their energy at Citgo gas stations and all along the eastern seaboard, providing heating oil for our homes and all kinds of stuff.
All right, well, you have to end it there. Thanks for joining us, Deborah James. Deborah James is the executive director of the Washington-based Venezuela Information Office, which is funded by the Venezuelan government. Judge her analysis on its merits. We'll be back after this break.
Tune to High Five. WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
And we're back on Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and certainly emphasizing Deborah James's point of a moment ago, there was a piece in the Financial Times earlier this week saying precisely that, that the oil industry has decided that they want Chavez to win his referendum because he's a man they can do business with, and it would guarantee some political stability in that country. So oil people are sometimes not our favorite people, but they also can just live with reality sometimes as well. And let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with Robert McChesney. Another excerpt from Paul Van Dyke's mix at Energy, recorded from last October. And you can download that from TranceAddict.com if you're so inclined. And now we're joined on the line by Robert McChesney, who is a professor at the University of Illinois and author of The Problem of the Media, U.S. Communication Politics in the 21st Century, published a few months ago by Monthly Review Press. And been meaning to get Bob McChesney on this show to talk about it, but just hasn't worked out until right now. But now we can celebrate his presence. Welcome to WBAI, Bob.
My pleasure to be here, Doug.
So, the problem of the media. What problem are you speaking of?
I'm glad you asked that question, because normally when you talk about the problem of the media, you talk about lousy journalism, corrupt journalism, lousy content, bad shows, vulgar shows, hyper-commercialism, just lousy media. And then, if you have great media and good content, there's no problem. Everything's fine. But I mean the term problem not only in that sense, although that's a big part of the book, but also in a more fundamental sense, a sense of a math problem or a social problem, that all societies face the issue of how to structure, organize, and devote resources to their system of communication and information, their media systems. And that's a social and political question all societies have to answer one way or another. It's unavoidable. There's no natural system for any society to assume. And that's how I think we have to think about media in our society.
One of the things I like about your books is that a lot of media people, media writers don't do this, but you look at the history of the thing. Your book about broadcasting that came out, about 10 years ago now?
We're dating ourselves here.
Yeah, from the Oxford University Press. Very excellent history of the development of broadcasting in the United States, but in this one you also deal with some of the history of media in the United States, and there's a tendency of people to think it's always been this way. It's always been a money-grubbing money-driven affair, but in the early part of our American history, it was not such. So could you review a little of that history for us?
I'd be glad to, because I think that's in the first chapter, and it's one of the most striking things in my own research over the last few years, because I think that there's a common sense notion today that freedom of the press in the United States means as long as the government doesn't interfere with commercial and private forces as they make as much money as possible, we'll have a free press, and that we'll just let the chips fall where they may. The crucial thing is to make sure the government doesn't interfere with the commercial interests as they try to maximize profit. And I think I sort of thought, gosh, that's probably what it does mean. I heard it enough times. I think it's probably in my crib, and my father was telling me that, leaning into it. And it sort of seems like, yeah, that must be what the founders of this country had meant with freedom of the press and get the government out of it and let private interests make money. And so finally, though, I went back to take a closer look at the drafting of the Constitution, of the First Amendment, and the debates around media policy in the first 100 years of this country's history. And I found a very different world emerge quickly. The idea that media, freedom of the press, meant that media should just be the province of commercial interests to make as much money as possible was broached by no one in the first 100 years of the Republic's history, certainly in the first 50 years. The idea would have been absolutely nonsensical. In fact, the founders of the Republic, and for the first several generations, were insistent that building a free press required explicit government policies to create it. It wouldn't exist otherwise. And in fact, as I talk about in Chapter 1 of the book, the early Republic had fundamental political debates over launching huge subsidies to spawn a much more diverse press than would have existed without them, most notably printing subsidies and postage subsidies.
And how long did that continue?
Well, actually, we still have the postage subsidies, postal subsidies of the state. The printing subsidies pretty much ended by the 1860s with the formation of the U.S. Government Printing Office.
And the early media in this country also didn't even pretend to be objective. It was very highly politicized and partisan, wasn't it?
That isn't even captured. I mean, the press system in this country through to the middle of the 19th century and arguably into the late 19th century wasn't simply partisan. That doesn't really capture it or opinionated or non-objective. It was a crucial part of the political system itself. I mean, all political parties and factions of parties were identified. They did their most important political outreach and work through their newspapers. I mean, they were the political system. And I think we understand that what the First Amendment meant with freedom of the press and not having Congress interfere with it makes a lot more sense. The real concern was they didn't want a government in power to outlaw dissident newspapers because that effectively outlawed dissident parties.
And what happened to all that? And how did we end up with this modern standard of, modern phony standard of objectivity?
Well, this is what I write about in the book. Chapters 2 and 3 are really an analysis of journalism in the United States today. And a lot of it's about the corporate control and commercialism and how that has affected journalism. But a big part of the discussion is on the issue of professionalism and objectivity and how that arose in journalism. It's, on one hand, somewhat of a complex history dealing with technology and a number of factors, but it's also a pretty simple story as well. And effectively, what happened is this. In the late 19th century, in the United States, we still had stridently partisan journalism. At the same time, newspapering was becoming a very profitable industry. This is when the great fortunes of the Pulitzers and the Hearst were being forged. And increasingly, what we saw happen in this country was that in market after market, or city after city, community after community, market pressures stimulated greatly by the rise of advertising, produced one and two newspaper towns, and it made it much more difficult for new voices to enter the market successfully in commercial marketplaces. So a city like St. Louis, Missouri, a major city in the United States, in 1870 had 10 or 15 daily newspapers, and it was pretty easy to start the 11th or 16th if you didn't like what was existing in the market. You didn't have to be a zillionaire to do it. Which meant that if you had stridently partisan journalism, it wasn't that threatening of a thing. If you didn't like the range of debate, you could start your own viewpoint. And our newspaper system, while far from perfect, tended to have a fairly broad range of opinion. But as the market became more and more consolidated and became more and more difficult for new people to start, the range of opinion became what you would expect predictably. It became much more the opinion and politics of the owning class. And it really became a major crisis by the 1890s or the beginning of the 20th century. Where our journalism was seen in a large number of circles, and not just on the political left, as being highly corrupt and driven to suit the political ambitions of owners. And it was in this environment that professional journalism, this sort of radical idea that you would separate the editor from the publisher, the owner from the politics of the newspaper, emerged. And we had no professional journalism schools in 1900. By 1920, all the major journalism schools that exist were already created, and usually at the behest of powerful publishers. And in effect, and this is sort of crude, but in effect what happened was the biggest publisher said, okay, we'll sacrifice explicit control over the politics of the newspaper, restrict those theoretically to the editorial page, and in exchange it'll divert attention from who owns the media, because it'll be irrelevant who the owner is, because it won't be reflected in the politics of the paper. We'll be neutral, and it won't matter if there's only one or two newspapers in a town, because we'll now be neutral. There won't be the same demand and insistence upon having more newspapers. And then this gets a long way to get to the point you were alleging or getting at, Doug, in your question, which is it's a phony neutrality. You know, the sort of professionalism that emerged in the United States, the sort of professional journalism we've gotten, I said, some serious problems built into it, not the least of which has been it's dependent upon official sources. And this is sort of the Achilles heel, so to speak, or Achilles tendon, so to speak, of professional journalism. And it explains, it's a big part of any explanation of our worst journalism, like the coverage of the build-up to the war in Iraq or coverage of the economy, the dependent upon the range of debate among those in power is legitimate journalism. And journalists who go outside that range of debate and sort of interject stuff people in power aren't talking about are accused of being unprofessional because they're challenging people in power and they're just doing it on their own, so they're weighing in with their own opinions. But, I mean, it's important to say, and something I go into the book that I don't think has been written about elsewhere, there's nothing inherent in the notion of professional journalism or neutral journalism that demands that it be the form that's taken place in the United States. It was very much shaped by commercial values and publisher pressure. In the 1930s, for example, the leading journalists of that age, George Seldes, Haywood Broun, the young I.S. Stone, were leaders in the movement to say, we need professional journalism that's independent of owners and not tied up with a specific political party or partisan in the traditional sense. But it has to be not just rely on official sources as the basis of news stories. It has to assume the mantle of those outside of power and representing them and make sure their interests are always weighed in the news. And that was really the politics of the Newspaper Guild, the Journalist Union, when it was launched in the 1930s. Their argument was they had to basically wrestle total control over the news away from owners and advertisers and have it be a democratic force. And, you know, I won't keep you in suspense, they lost that fight. But it was a political fight, and I think it's still a valuable way to understand that the two options for news aren't either bogus professionalism or strident partisanship. I mean, there's different models that are out there.
Speaking with Robert McChesney, professor at the University of Illinois and also author of a relatively new monthly review press book, The Problem of the Media, U.S. Communications Politics in the 21st Century. And along the lines of what you were just saying, I don't know if you saw the Washington Post today did one of those internal investigations of its own coverage of the run-up to the Iraq War by Howard Kurtz, their media reporter, and quotes their Pentagon correspondent, Thomas Ricks, as saying that they put all the stories that were sourced for the administration on the front page. Any skeptical or critical stories are put on page A16 or A18. And Rick said the reason for this was that the editors said that we know we're going to war, so why do we need to bother with all this critical stuff? That's almost an exact quote. I'm doing this from memory, but that's very close to what they said. So that's how our leading newspaper in Washington works.
Yeah, well, I think the build-up to the war in Iraq, and not just the invasion, but also the occupation, will go down as, you know, one of the all-time low marks of journalism in this country. I think the fact that now the Washington Post has joined the New York Times as announcing mea culpa is historically unprecedented, shows just how dramatic their propagandistic tone was during the war build-up and how dreadful it was. And it's just criminal isn't necessarily the correct word to use, but it's simply inexcusable and unacceptable. And it reflects the major crisis we have in media in this country. And I don't think readers and listeners and citizens of the United States should have any confidence that it'll be any better with the next time there's a build-up to war. There's no reason to think anything has been learned.
And you've also been talking about journalism schools, but my experience of those places, and they don't necessarily have to be this way, but they are the most brain-dead, anti-intellectual places around. There's a very narrow definition of professionalism and a hostility to ideas or critical thinking there that... even at, you know, the most prestigious ones, that it's really not hard to understand where the culture of journalism comes from once you've seen one of those places.
Well, oh, yeah, I hope my dean isn't listening. I think that there is a real movement in journalism schools, among a handful of them at least, and among journalism professors who get what the problem is, who understand that we're in a severe crisis of journalism. The Iraq War is just one example, but we basically have the end of viable journalism in this country today due to a number of factors. So the professional code not assisting the matters, but the commercialization of journalism reaching such a point that journalism's all but dead. And there are, I think, a handful of outposts where programs of journalism are sort of at a crossroads. Their decision they have to make is, are they going to train robots to go out and basically peddle stuff between the commercials and do sort of public relations fluff, which is what the market's calling for, basically? Or are they going to get people who really are talented journalists who are going to ask tough questions and do what journalism in theory is supposed to do? And it's a fight going on in journalism schools, like other struggles around the country. And it's a fight that, you know, there are good guys and there are bad guys. And I'm rooting for the good guys and working with the good guys.
But unfortunately, the structure of the industry is that the people who ask hard questions are not the ones who necessarily get promoted.
Oh, you're right. I think that there's a weeding out process in the organizational structure in our news media in particular. That the farther you go up the chain in the organization, the more likely you are to find people who will internalize the dominant values. I mean, this is not an original insight I've had. This is sort of a staple insight of all organizational sociology. In the corporate newsroom, it's not unlike probably what the newsroom was like in the Soviet Union under Khrushchev or Brezhnev, where, if you were to go into the Pravda headquarters in Moscow or the Izvestia headquarters, you did not find armed KGB agents pointing Uzis or AK-47s at the reporters, forcing them to write stuff that flattered the government. Instead, by the time someone made the Moscow newsroom, they had internalized the necessary values. If that was a problem for them, they would have been weeded out in Uzbekistan.
And let's talk a bit about the regulatory legal environment. There was the Telecommunications Act of 96, and of course, now Michael Powell at the FCC. What is this conjunction of things produced?
Well, I mean, put it in a broader context, going back to the point of departure for the interview, our whole media system today is based on a series of monopoly franchises and licenses and subsidies. It's not a free market system. And the policies that give away, like radio and TV monopoly licenses, cable franchises, or create copyright, which is nothing more than an artificial government intervention to prevent competition in marketplaces, the whole process by which these rules are created is done generally behind closed doors without a shred of public involvement or awareness or press coverage. And that's sort of the basis of understanding how we got the media system we got, is the corrupt nature of the policymaking. And one of the most central agency for the day-to-day running of the media system, one of them is the Federal Communications Commission, because it gives away these monopoly licenses to radio and TV channels, and has a lot to do with the gift of cable systems as well. That's done at the local level. And one of the central, probably the only form of regulation that's really had teeth in the United States has been ownership limits on how many monopoly radio and TV licenses a single company could have, both locally and nationally, and then how many other types of media companies that get these monopoly licenses were allowed to buy using their super profits from their radio and TV stations. And the reason why these limits had been successful historically over the years was that there was a very powerful commercial lobby that of small media owners that had a lot of influence over politicians that really were able to force there to be strong limits so you could keep smaller owners in radio and television and cable that wouldn't have existed if otherwise. And so this was sort of a fight that's been going on in Washington for decades. So the big media companies wanted to be able to buy up all the small ones using the regulations to keep markets more competitive than they would be otherwise. And the tide had been turning over the last 20 years as the big companies had basically gotten both parties increasingly to come to their side. And everything came to a head finally in 2002 when Michael Powell, the chair of the SEC, son of Colin Powell, and head of the five-member FCC, three of whom are Republicans because the White House gets to dominate. And he announced they were going to review the six remaining crucial media ownership rules with an eye to getting rid of them or greatly relaxing them. And at the time he announced this, I thought it was through. I think I wrote a piece in The Nation or in These Times or somewhere as John Nichols saying, hey, it's over. The fix is in. These guys run the FCC. The White House is totally in bed with Clear Channel and Rupert Murdoch. The head of the Democrats haven't been good on this issue, and the Republicans are awful, and they control both sides of Congress. And then history took one of those delightful turns we see periodically, like we're seeing in Venezuela right now. And millions of Americans rose up and said, no, we don't like the idea of concentrated media. We don't like the way our media system's going. We want to stop this. This is really outrageous. We got nearly 3 million people to contact the FCC or Congress during the course of 2003. On three different occasions, after the SEC, by a controversial 3-2 vote, relaxed the media ownership rules in June of 2003. On three different occasions after that, the Congress overturned it, but they couldn't get something through because of the Republican leadership in the House. And then finally, just a couple of months ago, the federal court in Philadelphia threw everything out, said what the SEC had done had been an outrage, and they had to go back to the drawing boards and do it right this time because it had been undemocratic the first time through. And that's where we are now. But we've won a victory so far, and the fight's been engaged. And we're really at a crucial turning point for media policymaking, not just in ownership, but in a whole range of issues in the next 3 to 5, 10 years. Whether we can take this issue and really get it out of sort of hidden away by powerful special interests and take advantage of the momentum that's been built up in the last couple of years, and put it on the agenda so that people understand that building a media system is the responsibility of a free people. It's not the responsibility of simply of corporate interest to do is to make as much money as possible.
That's the voice of Robert McChesney, a professor at the University of Illinois and author of The Problem with the Media, U.S. Communications Politics in the 21st Century, published a few months ago by Monthly Review Press, which is one of the hearty band of independent alternative radical publishers in this country, and would be much the poorer without the likes of MR. So let's spend the last few minutes of this interview thinking about a positive agenda. We can complain all we want about the crappy big corporate media, but how can we make things better?
Well, it's a multi-front fight. The fight that I've been interested in has been on the policy side, but that's not the only place we fight. And by the policy side, what I mean is the first thing we have to do is organize people to get them involved in these policy fights. So the analogy or the metaphor I like to use to describe how communication policies are made in the United States, I like to invoke the great film The Godfather 2 from 1974. Have you seen that, Doug?
I did, but it's so long ago I can't remember it.
You got to check it out again. It's such a great movie. When Brando died, you know, one of his great lines in the obituary was Brando said, "I never understood why people thought The Godfather was about the mafia. It's about capitalism." And The Godfather 2, much more so the case about than Godfather 1. And there's a classic scene about halfway through it when Hyman Roth and Michael Corleone and all the American gangsters are assembled on a patio in Havana. And it's 1958, Batista and the mob run Cuba. It's before the revolution. And it's Hyman Roth's 67th birthday, and he's got all the American gangsters there, and they're dividing up Cuba among them. So, you know, Hyman Roth's giving them a slice of his birthday cake, which appropriately enough has the outline of Cuba on it. And as he's giving a slice of Cuba to every gangster, he says, "Okay, Louis from Chicago, you run the Copacabana. Frankie from Detroit, you know, you get the prostitutes." So dividing up the island amongst them. And while Hyman Roth's doing that, he says, "Isn't it great to be in a country like Cuba with a government that respects private enterprise?" And that's basically how communication policies and media policies have been made in the United States, and ideally how they'd like to make them. And the metaphor holds true in another way, because while they all agree and they're all in cahoots that it's their system, that the public shouldn't have part of it, it's not a backslapping ceremony. Just like in that movie, Hyman Roth and Michael Corleone are duking it out for the biggest slice of the pie, so are these companies and these trade associations in the United States. They have enormous lobbying arsenals, not because they're concerned about you or me, at least not yet, because they're fighting each other for the biggest slice of the cake. That's what the real fight is. That's why they have these huge, huge, massive lobbying arsenals in Washington, why they're so difficult to defeat traditionally. So our crucial thing at the starting point of the policy front is to try to get the policy-making process taken off the Havana patio. The more public involvement there is, the more likely we're going to get better policies. That's the iron law that we work with. That's what we learned in the last 2 years on media ownership. Now, specifically, there's like 30, 40 different issues. If you go to the website for the group I helped start, Free Press, which is just freepress.net, you'll see maybe 40 issues that are being worked on, not just federally, but at the local level, policies that affect the media system. I think two core principles are in play. One, to the extent we have a commercial system, the bias should be to have as much diverse ownership and local ownership as possible. And two, even the more competitive, more locally run commercial system still has deep flaws. We need a strong, independent, pluralistic, heterogeneous, nonprofit, non-commercial media sector. And we have to come up with enlightened policies to push that ahead and make it more likely and not restrict that sector to the margins and the crumbs of the system while conceding the heart and soul of the system to the General Electrics and the Rupert Murdochs and the Microsofts. So those are the two guiding principles, I would say, in the policy front as we politicize debate. But having said that, there are other fights that complement and they go together. Groups and individuals working to expand high-quality independent media are absolutely critical because we have to have something we're fighting for, and we need to develop that sector without waiting around for government policies. And we have to do whatever we can to develop it. Movements to enhance the power of media workers to have more control over the product are fights, and it's really a policy fight because it's a labor law fight. But it's also it's an inside-the-industry fight. If nothing else changes, the more power goes to workers and away from owners, the better the content of media. So it's a heterogeneous, multi-front fight, and that, you know, policy is a big part of it.
And we only have a few seconds left, but give us a little plug for freepress.net. What's that all about? What will people find?
Well, I helped start a group that the whole mission is to get popular involvement in media policy struggles, ownership, public broadcasting, community radio, copyright, workers' rights, and it's at freepress.net, and it's a group that basically we try to collect and be an umbrella group. There are hundreds of groups now working on these issues around the country. a number of issues. We try to bring all the information together at the website, and we're focusing a number of campaigns people can learn about there. The striking thing, what's been exciting in the last year, is learning that when people learn about these issues, they get excited. It's not a difficult issue to organize around. Much to my surprise, frankly, I thought, like everyone else, boy, this is, no one gives a damn about this stuff. We can't organize on this. But what we found out is the soil is like 10-foot deep Iowa topsoil out there when you get out there and start talking and organizing around these issues. People really don't like what's going on in the media system in this country for a variety of reasons, on the left over to the right. And we can find common ground to organize around, and it's been very exciting.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Bob McChesney. Robert McChesney, author of The Problem of the Media, U.S. Communications Politics in the 21st Century, recently published by Monthly Review Press. And again, that website, freepress.net, freepress.net. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening, and I'll be back next week. And let's go out with a little more from Paul Van Dyke's Energy Mix, which you can get at transaddict.com. Bye.